a person should be able to safely use a piece of food and demonstrate that they can teach whatever they choose to teach. You know, it wasn't about the person must teach a sit, the person must teach a down. It's about the person must be able to use the tools of teaching and be able to teach what they want. And they'd come back the next week and I'd say, so what'd you get? Well, I got the dog to sit. Really? Wow, you're clever. Now, because they taught that themselves, they're never going to forget that. Never going to forget it because they worked it out themselves.
Too often our focus is about getting the behavior and not enough on the process of teaching or the learning process. If we focus on the process of learning, that will have an impact on every behavior the dog learns. The words of Kay Lawrence. I'm Sue McGuire. After this episode of Learning About Dogs, you may never approach learning any other way. Teach your students the skills of teaching dogs. Too often the focus is on the dog and not let's people. You always say let's teach people how to train, not what to train. Let's talk about that a little bit because sometimes we often have the focus backwards, don't we? We're like, just want to get the behavior.
I think on all scales, it starts from I want to stop the dog. Then we turn the person around to saying, I want to teach the dog, but it usually is for the human agenda. So we want to stop nuisance behaviors or the behaviors that annoy us or behaviors that annoy our neighbors, which embarrass us. So training tends to always be with this agenda that meets the needs of the people first rather than meets the needs of the dog. So instead of considering training as something that is the outcome based on what people want or what society wants, I think training should also be seen from the dog's point of view as to what's going to benefit the dog and how the dog grows because it's being trained, or how any animal benefits from the training process. Same as us, if we never went to school or never had education, would we be the people we are now? And that's not just an acquisition of knowledge. There's a whole bunch of skills that we learn through education that sets us up to do other things in life. She says as she struggled with the sewing machine yet again.
New skill.
Well, I went to a school that had to keep us entertained, you know, through to about 8 o'clock at night. And one of them was making clothes. But yes, I can sew. Wow. You know, sometimes I wouldn't say it's a joy. Wouldn't say it's a pleasure. But if I need to make something, I can.
It's handy.
So, you know, that was... Well, it was the sort of thing that young ladies had to learn, you know. Mm-hmm. Plus table manners.
I might have...
to make a conversation.
I kind of might have, I did, send my two daughters to sewing camp. Because I am of a school that you ought to know how to do basic things like hem a pair of pants, trousers, excuse me, how to make a pillow if you need to, how to make curtains, because it's so horribly expensive to have somebody make those for you. And maybe it's the
Also mending as well.
Yes.
You know, mending things. You know, how many people would know how to put a button on or repair a tear in a pair of trousers?
Yeah,
interesting. Exactly. Mm. Or make costumes for freestyle and kids, you know, kids' school stuff. Oh, Lord above. So those sort of craft things that are now gone are coming back again. We're all part of our education process, but it's about possibly something that you might have done in an art class that you would then transfer to an embroidery that you may then transfer to something else. So it's sort of, you know, this intergenerating ideas that go from one field to another. And, you know, so education is not just you have to learn this for this outcome so you can get a job. There are other things that you learn as part of education. And when we talk about a rich education, it brings all those other things along as well.
One of the things that I struggle with my clients in explaining why this might benefit the dog to learn this is this conversation about it's not mutually exclusive. What you want the dog to learn is not in opposition with what you actually want the dog to learn. It seems to be the power struggle.
Well, it comes back to, I want the dog to sit. Why? Well, so he doesn't jump up when I need to do things. So could we just get the dog to stand instead? Sure. Well, if the dog wants to sit, the dog can sit. The dog stands. But can we just find this middle ground where you're not making the dog do something because you think that's the only way it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. This is back to this recipe again. So provided you're getting what... Sorry, I'm still fighting a fly. Provided you're getting what you need, it shouldn't be at the expense of what the dog needs or can do or shouldn't or should do. Sure, a dog should learn how to be able to stand still at certain times for a whole host of reasons. And I think the chances of a stillness in stand succeeding are far greater than a sit. You know, when you want to cross a road, just stand still. Wait for me to cross the road. Mm-hmm. And even guide dogs now, I think Michelle was saying that guide dogs now don't require the sit at curb. You know, the dog is allowed to halt and stand because the sit at curb got the dog's tail trod on, you know, and it was this constant push, push, push to get the dog to conform as opposed to do what is a benefit to the dog. Mm-hmm. And we get stuck in this sort of spiral. And I think it's the same when you're teaching people in class. You know, 20 years ago, I produced a series of lessons and it was called Teaching People, Teaching Dogs. And in a college staff room, that seemed awesome that you had to not be able to teach the dog yourself. You had to teach a person who couldn't do it to a dog that couldn't do it. So you're double teaching at the same time. And to me, it takes just as long to teach a person the skills of training as it would to teach a person to copy what I do. So if we go back 20 years, it was always this take a lure, lure the dog's head up, sit, good sit, feed the dog stuff. And I, you know, no, not for me. Let's teach a person how to lure. So they would have a piece of food and they would ask the dog to take two or three steps. And if the dog took two or three steps forwards towards the hand, they opened their hand and gave them a treat. So they were learning about what the behavior looked like. They were learning how to teach major behaviors and small behaviors. They would teach the dog to go around a chair. They would teach the dog how to use a marker, which was this change from lure to open hand. They would learn the process of what reinforcement's about, and we used exercises for that. So my focus was about, at the end of this lesson, a person should be able to safely use a piece of food and demonstrate that they can teach whatever they choose to teach. You know, it wasn't about the person must teach a sit, the person must teach a down. It's about the person must be able to use the tools of teaching and be able to teach what they want. And they'd come back the next week and I'd say, so what do you get? Well, I got the dog to sit. Really? Wow, you're clever. Now, because they taught that themselves, they're never going to forget that. Never going to forget it because they worked it out themselves. So if you give them the means to do it, they can choose stand, sit or down, doesn't matter. They can choose in front of you, your left side or your right side, doesn't matter. So we teach the process of how reinforcers maintain or strengthen a behavior. We teach how lures can change a behavior, how the environment impacts on it. So by teaching, and it doesn't have to be complex, just very basic training skills, that person goes away learning more about dog training rather than having to just copy recipes. And I don't think there's any greater length of time to teach it. I think people get more motivated because they're learning something that's for their benefit, i.e. they're learning how to do something, which is their personal skills increasing. And at the end of the day, our problem is not so much do we have the time to do this, is how do we get rid of them? Because now they're motivated. They want to go and do more. Oh, good, good. Well, this course has ended right now. Yes, but we like this. We want to do more. And think how many people got into dog training because of that first class they went to and it opened their eyes. They said, this is cool. I enjoy this. I want to do more of this. So that's the teachers we have to be. This is why I don't like to use the word instructor. We teach people about dog training. And if you're going to evening class, you know, whatever you're going to learn in evening class, it's about learning how to do something, not about copying what somebody else does. So if I was going to evening class to learn a new language or to learn a new computer program, the instructor just doesn't say, copy this, write this down. It's about teaching you how to be able to do something. And I think if we could change evening classes to go back to that sort of, what is the person learning, not just this is how you get the dog to walk on a lead, this is how you get the dog to stop on a recall, and these sort of fixed behaviors, we then enable that person to become a trainer of all the dogs they own or live with.
Oh, we really did flip it around. We messed it up, didn't we?
Well, you know, if you were going to sign up to an evening class, what would you fancy going out to learn?
Something entirely new.
Well, yes. Yeah. For what purpose?
So I can learn how to do it myself, right? Right.
Well, no, because example, what would you like? So now you've got 3 evenings a week free, and you look through the local brochure for your, to us would be our local colleges. Mm-hmm. And what's going on in the evenings? Something you can do in a term.
Oh, could there's be a lot of, yeah, it could be. And there's a lot of watercolor classes, and there's a lot of painting classes. And
so like are you going to go along to expect to, this is how you paint people, this is how you paint trees, or are you going along to learn how to use watercolor?
Mm-hmm. How to do brush strokes, how to, hold the brush,
I mean, there are probably tips that will come along in the way going, it's just a bit easier if you hold your brush this way. But essentially, they're going to teach you how to use watercolors, not how to copy a diagram on how to paint a dog's head. Are you with me?
Yes.
I think we've just lost this whole point of, you know, my business is called learning about dogs because learning is the key thing and teaching is my job, not instructing and copying. So to give that value of a class to a person, we need to think about, well, what's this person going to have by the time they finish this course? What's of a greater value to them that they can leave with? And I think we owe the same to the dogs. How's this dog going to grow from what they've done in classes, for what we train them to do?
And how's this person going to grow from what we've taught them?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there will be, oh, no, I don't want to bother with that, but I rarely find it. But maybe people don't come to the classes to be fixed, yes, or to be told how to do this or told how to do that. Maybe they come along because they want to learn. That might be the pitch my classes have. But I think once we say we're going to teach you how to use watercolor, I don't think Emma's going to turn around. So I don't want to learn how to use it. Just show me how to paint a tree.
Yeah.
Don't think that would happen.
Yeah.
You know, I remember one client, again, about 20 years ago, he came to learn about the lead walking. He got it in the first lesson and he said, do you mind if I don't come back for the other 11? That's exactly what I wanted to learn. And I said, absolutely not. But he got it straight away. Super. He said, off again. Fine. And that's one person that didn't want to stay. He just needed that last missing element that he couldn't quite get his head around.
So when you bring these clients into your class, you mentioned about how you teach them the reinforcement process. You teach them, what do you teach them? I mean, like, what's your first opening gambit to them? I'm assuming they don't
Use food.
How to use food. Okay.
And what? Well, no. If it's our life skills, it's how to park the dog, which is just being able to have the dog at your side, have the lead loose enough so that you can stand on it and stand up. So it needs to be a 6-foot lead. And the dog is not pinned to the deck. The dog is just now pretty much 90% unable to get itself into trouble. So now you can listen to me. Now you can watch another dog do something. Without that parking the dog, people are struggling to get the dog to sit, struggling to get the dog to behave, struggling to get the dog to lie down. And I've probably got 10% of their focus on me, you know, which is not a good teaching environment. So parking the dog pretty much is where we begin.
Okay.
That usually takes about 10 minutes. After that, how to use food safely. You've got to start with all your safety issues. And then we will use that food to lure a dog to do things. And it might be, you know, I have carpet tiles on our floor and I have different areas. And I'd say, I want you to lure the dog to walk around that carpet square or around that cone or underneath that chair. And everybody that comes with the dog can get involved in this and I can oversee their process. Somebody's going to think, oh, I'm going to get bitten. Okay, let's have a look at that. How can we stop that? Oh, I see. So show the dog that this is when you can take it. And this is when you follow it. Oh, that's a good idea. And then we do some outside stuff on the bricks. We have a lot of house bricks and planks. And people teach the dogs to walk with them on the planks and then use reinforcers to make that behavior stronger. You know, so the whole process is about people learning how to use reinforcers, looking at what could be cues, looking at the way they behave, you know, learning about training.
Talk about
and if we teach the,
I'm sorry. Do you go into depth about what kind of reinforcers? Or you just kind of let them work with whatever they show up with, and then come back.
We certainly make the difference between what's a reward and what's a reinforcer. And often we look at play, so probably the second half of any class is play, and then we certainly come into how you tend to reinforce. You know, the classic one is the dog brings a toy back but puts it 3 foot short. So now the person steps forward, picks up the toy and throws it again. I go, do you realize just what's happened there? Oh, yes. You know, so the whole thread of that is not how to get the dog to chase the ball or how to get the dog to give it to hand. The thread of that is looking at how the reinforcers are in play between the dog and you and the dog, how the dog is getting you to do things for them. So I think if we give the people these skills, we're opening up lots of doors and they can start to see it in everyday life. You're setting them up to reduce the risk of them having annoying behaviors in the future. Mm-hmm. Yes, because they can start to see the whole process of how the dogs are learning these things.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, you must have been able to observe this over a few years, because I can tell you, sometimes I'm just amazed about how little observation people do of their dogs.
But this is, I started over 40 years ago, but we had set up something like, I might pull every ear to one side of the room and the dogs are going to do a circuit around the room. Again, I've set up the carpet so that there's a band of different color carpet around the edge. So I can send people around the room by just asking them to follow the brown carpet. And we call that then the sidewalk or the pavement. And as they're going around, I will start to introduce things and they have to make decisions about what they do. Well, one person might be going around the room. The other five, I'm asking them questions about what's happening. So they're learning to watch what people are doing. They're learning by watching other people learning to do something. Yes. And they'll walk up to the mat that's like bubble wrap, mm-hmm. and written on the bubble wrap is "Here be vomit." So by the time they come up there, what do they see? When they see it says vomit, they pull the dog back. Okay, well, probably the first person does that, but the second and third won't, because they've learned to anticipate what's likely to happen. Mm-hmm. They've learned how to move the dog over to go past this safely. So they shorten their lead and they ask the dog to close in and they'll go past the vomit. Or they'll have to step over something, or they'll have to walk past something like a stuffed dog. And as they go round and the circuit finishes, I will then ask them to analyse what did the dog find difficult, what did the dog find easy. And they said, oh, when that Dalmatian went past so-and-so, I thought he was going to do this, that and the other, but he didn't, did he? And, you know, so we'll discuss it, we'll have a look at it, we'll analyse it. So you're introducing these questions all the time. And then we'll go around the circuit again. And each time you go around the circuit, I make it something different. So the dogs are learning to assess where we're going out for a walk, which is a key skill of assessment. How safe is this going to be? Is this going to be a risk? Should I cross the road now? Or how fast is that traffic actually coming towards me? These are all skills that we have to teach. Well, you can only teach it by setting up the environment where people can learn from it. But then we also have to review what they've learned. You can't just say, okay, come back next week. You know, there has to be a process whereby you share the experience of what you've learned, which then makes the learning more valid. Particularly when you share it with other people that are in the same situation.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm. Do you find a lot of buy-in when people are asked, what are your priorities for you and your life together? Do people stop and think about that? Do they, other than saying the typical, stop doing that, stop doing this, but more depth, more beyond that. I love asking.
No, we're British. No, I don't ask that. I don't even know what it is myself. What are my priorities? Oh, just get on by, you know, whatever. No.
Oh, my goodness, Kay, you need to
maybe it's part of rescue. No. Maybe it's part of the American life.
No, it's part of West Sonoma County life, but that's okay. You know, call us hippies, what you will. But here's the thing, and you do bring up an interesting subject, because we are a little forced into adapting to our population. I can't turn my West County hippies into a bunch of Brits overnight. That's just not in my skill set.
Sure. But then how would it, I don't know, how would that benefit? You're asking people a pretty philosophical question, like, what is the purpose of owning this dog? Well, I just liked it. Good. Okay, on we go. So where do you want to go with this dog? Well, I just want to enjoy living with it. Well, isn't that common to all of us?
Yeah.
You know, so I think you could ask questions that take you forward. Sometimes the answers you get when you sort of ask this must be a bit like, okay, fine, right, okay, maybe that's not why I have dogs, but, you know, it's like, I just like dogs, so there we are. Yeah. I prefer to share life with dogs, you know. And, you know, the whole reason people have dogs is as varied as haircuts, you know. It's entirely individual. And my reasons for owning a dog, I don't know, are the same as anybody else's. Mm. You know, so how does that influence what you're going to do? I mean, certainly if you're rehoming dogs to people, you need to be a bit careful about what they want. I mean, I might ask those questions if I was breeding puppies again. What's the purpose of having this puppy? What do you hope to get out of it? But I've probably got to know this person long before they sit looking at the puppies.
Yeah.
You know, I know what sort of handler they are, what type of trainer they want to be, and I will select the puppy that I think is most suited for what they're looking for.
I guess what I'm dealing with a lot is people who want their dog to be their spirit animal.
Oh my God.
Oh, I am not kidding.
Okay.
I am not kidding. So if that is my starting point, not that you need to coach me on how to teach people who think these guys, I can remember being at Wolf Park last summer and Dr. Friedman saying, "Where's your evidence that wolves are your spirit animal?" And I but that is kind of often where my starting point is with people. And, you know, and I want to honor, I'm looking at that as a translation, is they're just seeking a really deep connection with this animal. And I appreciate that. But
you know, you're opening a door that you might not be able to do anything about. So, that's a tricky one, isn't it? You know, so surely on a more practical basis is how much space do you have for the dog to play around in? How much time do you have every day? All those things are the deeper questions, aren't they? What comes out of that might be a spirit animal, but maybe if you're trying to seek that, you don't know it's going to happen until you're 2 years further down the road.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the dogs that we've lived with that turned out to be nothing like what we thought when we first started, and dogs that we thought were going to be everything we wanted and didn't really pan out, you know. So each dog is its own. Whatever the relationship is, it's individual to you and that dog.
Hmm. Yeah.
Cool.
I really want to...
Maybe too much philosophy.
Well, no. Welcome to my world.
I did have somebody ask me if she... Well, yes, I do remember some of the Californian expos were a little, okay, maybe you should ask Karen about that because I can't answer you. I'm British.
Yes. No, but anyway... That is often my starting point. And how do we kind of narrow that down? I mean, one of the things that I love is that they are learning all the time anyway, our dogs. It's that thought of, you know, you can actually guide this, what you want them to learn. You can guide this. And without...
Can you?
Well, I think you can by contingencies for sure. But... I don't know.
Such as what? What could you guide them that you want them to learn?
Let's see. I was at the river last weekend. I don't know if you saw my video of Hank Williams swimming toward me. I wanted him to learn that. A really good example is I want my dogs to learn that every time they're near me, it is a reinforcing positive. They're my spirit animals, right? They're near me. Okay.
Okay. So what happens when you take them to the veterinary office and you have to hold them while their ears are checked out?
Yeah. They look right at me and they hold me. And I say dumb things like, trust me.
Yeah. No. I mean, you can't, maybe it's the use of English. What you want them to learn is about what you want. Are you with me?
Yeah.
What would they want?
Get out of the vet office.
You know, so it's about you can only set up environments where the learning may occur, but you can't say, this is what I'd like them to learn. You can set them up opportunities to learn, and what they learn is what they learn, but we often don't know what they learn unless we can actually measure what's happened in that process.
So that's where you go to metrics, period. I mean, is everything about metrics? I guess I'm just sort of like...
No, but if I'm teaching something, I can't say... I'm teaching you to be more bonded to your animal. How on earth would I know whether that's what I've taught or not?
Yeah. Well,
so if I was teaching, Zip, so she's secondhand, shall we say. So I would like her to learn that being around me should give her a feeling of safety. But I know there's times I have to lift her up and put her in the car, which she doesn't like. This morning she had to go to the vets and have somebody poke around in the bottom of her ear. And this young, very energetic and enthusiastic vet said, "Is she okay?" And I go, "So far." And then we went, "Okay, no, she's not." As he poked something down her ear. Well, that's a first. There we go. We don't know what's going to happen, you know. So I would like her to learn that what I'd like her to learn is not necessarily what I can get her to learn. That's the difference. Yep. I would like her to learn to tolerate veterinary processes. Yes, but that's not necessarily what she's going to learn.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not necessary that and they, I can only... yeah. Okay, I agree with that.
So, you know, you took him swimming. You wanted him to learn to swim. But these are your wants. You're basing it on what you want. You say, well, he's going to have a great time if he can learn to swim, but it doesn't matter if he doesn't.
Right.
You wanted to give him the opportunity, but we can't say what we want them to learn. Does that make sense?
No. Yeah, it does. I'm just sort of heartbroken.
What, that he hasn't learned to swim?
Oh, no, he has learned to swim. But here's my sticky wicket, and I'm sure I'm not the only trainer who feels this way, is that, wow, I really want him to learn this because I enjoy it. And if he enjoys it too, it's all the better. So then I think, am I asking I obviously would look for signs that the dog is, you know, clearly not going into the water, staring away, you know, not wanting to enter the water. That would be my metrics. He's 2 feet away. There's my metrics, not wanting to go in the water, as opposed to a dog who just plows right into the water. So that would be my metrics.
Yeah. So, you know, but I think it might be about the words you use. You want him to enjoy life, and you are saying, if you swim, you're going to enjoy it. Well, there are dogs that... have you ever had a dog that really doesn't like to go to new places?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
So we could say, well, I want this dog to be able to travel around with me. Well, actually, this is a dog that really doesn't want to go to new places. Oh, I want this dog to learn how much fun retrieving is. Well, this is not a dog that actually is going to enjoy retrieving. Zip is a little madam for being 6 footer end of me on the end of the lead. And then I realize she's not pulling so much as she recognizes where I want to go and wants to get there first. So if the lead's not there, she's at the gate. And if I've gone for a walk around the fields, the minute I about turn and look like I'm heading home, guess where she is? Back on the other side of the gate, 400 yards away. So once the lead's on her, it looks like she pulls on the lead. But this is just her desire to say, oh, we're heading to the car. I'll go and sit by the car. Okay, we're going out the car. We're going to the barn. Okay, I'll go and sit by the barn. So anticipating where I want to go causes her to try and get there first. The outcome is that she chunders along on the end of a lead. And I just go, the lead pulling is not the issue. The issue is that she's being extremely bright and going, I know where you're going. You're going upstairs. So she goes up ahead of me. Mm-hmm. I know where you're going. So what I want is her not to pull on the lead, but I'm missing why she's doing what she's doing. So by not understanding what she's doing, I can't actually teach her not to do it. That makes sense?
Yes, it does.
So, you know, I mean, I've had a collie that would never go in the water because she always wanted to work the dog that was in the water. So I'd throw a toy out and Abacab would go out and fetch it. And my other dog's standing by the side of me, staring the hell out of him. But she's a collie. So I think the first time she went in the water and laid down like a collie, she nearly drowned. So she thought, well, I'm not going back in there. I'll stand on the shore. And as he comes out the shore, I'll get the stick off him that way. Yes. Nah, she's never going to swim.
Why?
For her, swimming's a waste of time. You can't get the stick off the other dog if you go swimming.
You do bring up this interesting conundrum of every dog teacher of people, of teacher of dogs in the world, is that if I were a good enough trainer, I could teach this dog yada yada. Can you address that a little bit? Because I think people misconstrue that.
So try that again.
Well, okay.
Reword that again. I'm not quite sure what I mean.
I have conversations a lot with people who say, if I were a better trainer, I could teach enter the blank.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Don't you hear that a lot?
No. There's two things. One there. I could teach this dog. My first question is why?
Exactly.
Why have you got to teach this dog to me? We set up the situation where the dog learns from the environment, the reinforcers, the cues, and what they learn is what they learn. If you go back and say, no, I want the dog to, I should be able to teach the dog to do anything I want, that to me brings up an arrogance that's just, ooh, I don't know where that comes from. Mm-hmm. I mean, could I teach a dog to do anything I want? Possibly, but the first question is, why would I want to? Yeah. You know, it's a little bit like saying, well, I could teach you to play the piano exceptionally well, and you're going, I don't really want to. I don't care. I'm a teacher. I could teach you to do that. Yeah, but I might not be very good at it because I'm not very musical. It doesn't matter. I'm a teacher. I will teach you how to do it. Does it see how coercive it starts to get?
It does.
You know,
it does.
Whoa.
Yeah.
You know, and there's so many sort of lifestyles where we've had to, all of us have had to conform to be able to be part of a society or community that we're in. And how much of that is not being true to who you are? You know, the dog should be able to be true to who they are as much as we can, not to the point of causing harm to themselves or anybody else, but to say that I should be able to teach any dog to do anything, I don't see the point of that.
Well, let's go back to the husbandry discussion. I think that husbandry is one of those things that, I'll just be honest with you, I kind of pretty much suspect my dogs don't enjoy it at all. But it is necessary for them to tolerate it in terms of good health and our lives together.
Sure. But it's the same as us. I mean, you know, you've had more than one examination that you didn't enjoy.
Right. Right. Doesn't affect our relationship.
On a regular basis.
Right. It doesn't affect our relationship overall, you know.
I remember, Ken, going through, have you probably there, I was on the ship. I definitely went on the ship. And he was talking about this young train that was very enthusiastic, wanted to train this zebra to present itself at the fence for husbandry. And after a year, I think it was somewhere he went on a regular basis, not where he actually worked. And after a year, she was still making slow progress. So the question was, do we dart this animal to do what we need to do, which I think was hoof work, mm-hmm. or do we carry on putting it through this training process? And in his view, the continual training process was probably more stressful than the occasion to dart it, do it, have it done, finish. So there are more questions to be asked that, yes, I know you're not going to like this. Sorry. There you go. Have a piece of chicken. You know, how much is the capture, do it, get it over and done with as quick as possible? How much do you have to weigh up that being less stressful than the process of me going through it bit by bit by bit on a daily basis? I don't know.
Yeah.
I think that you have to know the individual animal. You have to know whether proximity is comfortable for them. You know, there's so many questions to ask on this. You can't just assume that if I've trained husbandry, he'll enjoy it. No, sometimes it's just, let's just dart the dogs and
we just
call it a day on that.
Yeah, yeah. Must have looked into my office because I'm in the midst of teaching a dog to accept a muzzle. And it's 3 weeks in.
Well, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, we had to, you know, Zip had to have a muzzle on. I've worked with vets for long enough to know that when they are trying to diagnose something, they're often not aware of what's going on in the corner of their eye, especially when they're young and enthusiastic. Mm-hmm. So this young lad, she's got something like a grass seed down the bottom of her ear. The options are we anaesthetize her, have a good investigate, see if there's anything there, take it out. But option number one is you might be able to see it and you might be able to oik it out before we have to do anything too serious. So he was having a good old nosy around her ear and obviously touched something that hurt her, and I managed to stop her taking a chunk. I don't think she would have got a chunk. So anyway, it made him jump, and I felt like saying, yeah, you shouldn't assume. And I got a good hold of her, so it was no harm. So he said, well, let's go and get a hat for her, which is a British euphemism for a muzzle.
Oh.
And I just, you know, I was holding her, I put it on, and there you go, fine. And we carry on. That dog didn't need muzzle training for this occasion. We just put a muzzle on. We did it. There wasn't a grass, so you couldn't find it. She'll have some eardrops for a couple of weeks, and we'll see how that goes. So for the first time in her life, she had one of these fabric muzzles on her face for safety, mm-hmm. and she was fine. She was fine. But I put it on, and I do it from behind, not from in front.
Right.
You know, so, yeah, she was fine on that. But, you know, even before muzzles were around, there were quite a few veterinary procedures where the dog could be contained and the vet be safe. but I do think there are certain different criteria. So if a vet nurse is holding a dog, stillness is her priority. If I'm holding my dog, comfort is probably my priority. You know, so the different ways of actually achieving husbandry are different from whatever we're doing. So three of us working on one dog for different reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Okay. I will remove my guilt then. Sorry, I'm going to have to do this for right now. It's not going to hurt for very long. Trust me later. Okay.
But, you know, that's a bit like you bandaging a foot because it aches, you know, or having stitches. Yeah, no, get on with it. Let's do it. But, you know, it's dental treatment. You know, none of it's pleasant. I know we can work out that it's going to be okay, but, you know, quite a lot of things that dogs do aren't always pleasant, and sometimes they do it themselves.
Yeah.
Chewing a leg.
Well, you know, I have to tap into my, when I first started in this line of work, I was very much a farm girl from the country. Uh-huh. And I was a very pragmatic farm girl. And I just didn't understand this whole this fuss. And then I got super duper fussed about making sure that we asked permission and we showed choice. And I thought, you know, have we gone too far to the other side? Sometimes we just need to get stuff done. And
I think that's, sometimes we need to get stuff done, but I think we can do it in such a way that the animal goes, oh, okay, I can see what's coming. I'm not going to enjoy it, but get on with it.
Yeah.
I think you say the guilt to make it a pleasant event is something that seems to be the person's burden. And I think at times we're not actually learning to observe, actually, you've just gone one step too far, you know, and I may have to hold a dog still while something happens. Cool. Oh, gosh, you've done really well. Sorry about that, but there we go. Because I knew the alternative was a full anesthetic, day of, you know, in the hospital overnight, blah, 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 blah. But in actual fact, just, you know, put up with this for another minute and we'll be out of here. Mm. And I think maybe that comes out of having a relationship with the dog that, yeah, you've got sticky things all stuck around you. Let me just take it off your coat. And it comes from those sort of experiences where we do things to the dog. And as an outcome of that, they feel better. So Merrick jumped in the car the other day and I had been cleaning it out. So her bedding wasn't in there. And you could see she sat there and she was like, well, there's nothing comfortable here whatsoever. So I went and got her something comfortable. Very good. Thank you very much, person. You know, so their life goes through things that are not right and person puts it right. So sometimes person might not get it right and it might take 2 or 3 minutes before person puts it right. But there's a trust that person can put things right. You know, have you ever had a dog got stuck somewhere and you've gone and let them out, or they've tried to do something and got their foot jammed on the sides of the crate and you've come and let them out? You know, life is full of those small events where person does something good that stops you being frightened, uncomfortable, in pain. And even the small events build up to, oh, I can trust this person. I'm sure something's going to sort itself out here, you know? Well, that's what we like to think.
We like to think.
Takes my guilt away anyway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, you mentioned it's words. When I'm in the midst of doing Hank Williams' nails, I just say, dude, trust me. And I just say that to myself more than him. And by golly, he trims his nails, you know? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't really care. Yeah. He does it. He still likes...
I mean, how much husbandry do we do that doesn't make the dog feel better afterwards? You know, Merrick gets little, she's got this long coat underneath and it gets all these nasties in it. And she really doesn't like to be groomed, but she'll do it because she gets food. And I'm not conning myself, she likes it. She'll do it because she gets food. And it's very much linked to only when she's on the grooming table. Because if I try and groom her anywhere else, she's out. There's no two ways about it. Mm-hmm. So it's about, you pay for this and you can do what you like with my coat. But if she's got something sticky, we have these nasty things called Sticky Williams around at the moment, which are like long strands of crap that tie themselves around the dog's leg and then leave seeds behind. Now she'll come running to me once this is on her in the middle of a field with absolute abject distress, you know, person, get the stuff off me, I can't possibly move and I have to get the stuff off her, and off she goes, you know. So it's not that she doesn't trust me, but I've got skills that she might wish to make use of. She also gets terrified if she gets a Klingon hanging down the back of her bottom as well, and has to have that removed as well. So, you know, there's things we do to them that they end up feeling less distressed afterwards. So that's the whole process of learning to live with dogs, isn't it? with a go-to guy. And even cutting nails should make them feel slightly comfortable after they've been done.
Yeah. In your article, you write, our training is about giving them learning skills. And you list observation, awareness, memory. Are these things that you intentionally provide avenues for learning, or is it just something that you observe, like, I mean, you know, when you say observation, watching the order and pattern of peers and their family, awareness of their environment. These are things that they...
Okay, yes. Yes, so these are skills. So say you were very skilled in all of these, observation, awareness, memory, puzzle solving, definitely, physical skills, mental skills, using your innate... If you were well skilled in all these areas, life would not throw up nearly so many distressing events for you, because you could puzzle solve out of them. You could work out what's happening. And even like the... So observation skills... Zip works out patterns of my behavior, I say, anticipating that once we've gone for a walk around the field, as soon as I face the gate, we're going to go back through the gate. So she's gone through the gate. And as soon as I look at the car, I am going, so she works out these patterns of how life around her will have some relevance for her. This is a learning skill. Now, can you imagine dogs that you've got at your center that are deprived of these events? Yes, they spend most of the time not being able to learn these skills, or they've been in deprived areas where they don't get to see what people do, or they don't get to memorize, or it's limited to what they can do, then their ability to adapt to new environments is probably compromised. So having that, in our terms, we call it a rich education, means we've probably got enough depth of learning that we could adapt to difficult situations. But without that depth of learning, we're more likely to panic and more likely to become distressed by events that other people would be able to cope with. Does that make sense? So to me, giving a dog a rich depth of learning sets them up to be able to cope with quite often life that is not very comfortable for dogs.
In the episode notes, you will find links to classes and courses taught by Kay Lawrence through Learning About Dogs. And for those who live in the San Francisco Bay Area, a chance to learn in person with me at the Humane Society of Sonoma County near Santa Rosa. Are you interested in a topic for a future podcast? We encourage you to go to Facebook and look for the group Whilst I Was Listening to the Podcast and leave a comment. As usual, post a starred review on Apple iTunes and leave a review. Thanks for listening.